Hey everybody, this is Autoblog podcast producer Eric here. I'm just hopping in quickly at the beginning of the episode to let you know that this episode of the Autoblog podcast is brought to you by the SoFi Daily podcast. Reaching financial independence starts with having the right information. So every weekday morning, SoFi keeps you up to date with important business news and stock market happenings and how they affect your financial life. So get your money right and search for SoFi, that's S-O-F-I, wherever you get your podcasts. On with the show.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Autoblog podcast. Welcome back. We got a great show for you. Thank you for listening. We're going to cram a lot into our new segment, talking about the next generation Z car. The Honda Fit is done. I'm actually sad about this. I have a lot of good memories in the Honda Fit. We had a long-term one when I was at Auto Week, and I always thought they were a ball to drive. We're going to talk about the Mercedes EQS. What is going on there, essentially? I think that's a sort of an electric vehicle program that sometimes flies a little bit below the radar. And then, speaking of electrics, the electric Humvee perhaps could be based on GM's Hummer, and this could be used for U.S. Army applications, which could be interesting. We'll talk about the Kia K5, the Mini Cooper GP, both of those being driven by one of my co-hosts, that's Joel Stocksdale. We have a new segment called Love It or Hate It, which we may never do again, but every week we're essentially making up a segment and trying it. Chuckling right there is my other co-host, John Snyder, because the last time he was on, we did a segment entirely on beer. So it's summer, man. You can do whatever you want. We also have a cool interview. Our senior producer, Christopher McGraw, did an interview with Jimmy Chin. He's an Oscar-winning director, filmmaker, who did those Ford Bronco commercials that I'm sure you all watched a couple weeks back. And finally, we'll spend your money. With that, I'm going to bring in my co-hosts, senior editor for all things green, John Snyder. What's up, man?
Hey, just enjoying this beautiful weather we're having today. It's not too hot, which is nice because my AC is out.
Ooh, that is rough. That is rough. You may hear my AC click on. I'm in the basement. You get a little bit of that sort of reverb. Hopefully you don't too much. I apologize now, podcast listeners, but it's quiet down here. Probably in a nicely cooled place, I would think, is our news editor, Joel Stocksdale, who, you know, I hope his air conditioner is working. But what's going on, Joel?
Well, actually, it's kind of funny you mentioned that because my air conditioner actually isn't working. But I do have a portable one that has been kind of filling in the meantime. But otherwise, well, things have been going all right.
That sounds good. My refrigerator is actually kind of broken. It's just like, it's really weird. Like, how is your refrigerator kind of broken? It broke like basically 2 months ago, like right when coronavirus was still really going on and everybody was like hoarding food. So it was really bad. But we were able to get this like mini college fridge and you can actually get a ton of stuff in it. So I finally got around to fixing it, which is crazy because I don't know the first thing about fixing a fridge, but it's kind of working again now. So I'm like in this kind of like no man's land. Like basically I'm willing to put everything in there, but like milk, like you don't want your milk to go bad,
right?
And maybe meat, but the freezer also works really well. So it's like right now we have literally three different fridges scattered throughout the house and it's just kind of working. It went from being like a huge, like four alarm problem to this minor annoyance that I think I'm going to get a fridge, but if I don't, it's not a problem at this moment. So it's really weird.
It's interesting how this sort of quarantine has made me try my hand at fixing things that I never would have thought I would have been able to fix before. And it sort of gives me a little bit of hope. I mean, Joel, you're already, you know, seasoned at working on cars, but it makes me want to get a project car now. Like, I feel a little more confident. I'm surprised when I'm able to fix something and it actually works. So hopefully, yeah. Someday soon, I'll be getting a project car.
So, John, I'm going to totally derail this podcast real quick. My brother and I have our parents' old Chevelle. And
yes.
We are thinking of probably not fixing it up ourselves, but it's going to fall into that sort of project car bucket, assuming it's not too rusted out. It's a 73, so it's the Colonnade hard top style. People like to say the 73 is either the start of the end, or how I like to look at it, the last great Chevelle. And that's how I look at it. I think the back end still has some of those great dynamic styling cues from the 60s. You look at those like quad headlights up front. It's a little more awkward, mainly because of the crash test, the bumpers, the, what is it, the 5 mile or 15 mile an hour bumpers went into effect like that year. But overall, I've been super psyched. I hope this works out. We'll just see. But that's that's the project car that's on my radar now.
I would hold on to it. I've regretted getting rid of every car I've ever sold.
Yeah, I think you should. I think you should pick up a project car. You should totally pick up a project car. Like part of the reason that I got the Beetle relatively recently was because I'm kind of at a point with my Miata where there's not really much else that I want or need to do to it. And so I was like, well, I need something else that I can modify. And so I got the bug.
Yeah.
You got the bug, literally. See what I'm saying there to,
I've got the bug to get a classic Beetle. I've been wanting to get, you know, an old Beetle or Super Beetle forever, ever since, you know, my friend out in Oregon had him and we drove him up and down the Oregon coast. It's just such a fun car to drive.
That sounds like a scene from The Graduate or something, like a coming of age drama. They drive up and down the West Coast. They put away their East Coast life and drove up and down Oregon. That sounds great. I would say as far as like, I wouldn't call them project cars because again, I'm not particularly good at that sort of thing, but hey, maybe I fixed a refrigerator. I would like an 87 Cutlass Supreme. That would be a fun thing to drive around in. I know I'm speaking John's language right here. 96 Chevy Impala SS, or maybe a 73 Chevelle. But I could also totally go with just like that extra car would be an old Land Cruiser, about maybe 15 years old.
You'll have plenty of opportunities to fix that over and over again.
Right. Get really good at it. Really good.
And like, I totally feel like you don't need to get like a basket case kind of vehicle to be able to call it a project car, just something that you'd mess around with here and there.
Yeah.
Real quick, around the horn, your next two project cars, money's no option, but be somewhat realistic. By project, I mean something you'd like to put in your garage, do a few things to, maybe pay somebody to do a few things to. Real quick, what would those two be? We'll start with you, Joel. After the bug.
Gosh, the next two? Well, I definitely want something with a V8 sometime, and I've thought a lot about the C5 Corvette. It's one of my favorite generations.
That's interesting.
They're fairly affordable. There's a big aftermarket for them. I love the way they look. They're so low and long and wide, and they've got the pop-up headlights, and I really like the way it looks. It's got a crummy interior, but it looks good on the outside, and everything I've read says that it drives really well. So that's one of them. And sort of an unorthodox project, which is actually probably more likely what I'm looking at, is I'd like to kind of customize some kind of plug-in hybrid or electric car.
That's ambitious.
Yeah, obviously there wouldn't really be much in the way of performance upgrades that you could do, but like I've actually looked a lot at the BMW i3. There's actually a number of like body kits and like neat wheels and stuff you could get for it. But I thought, you know, that would be a cool, just like commuter eco car, with some style and reasonably fun to drive. Although I'm also hoping that we'll get some neat future electric cars. I really want Mazda to bring the MX-30 here. I love the way that thing looks. The Honda E would be awesome. I don't know what the odds are of that coming here, because at least the Mazda has kind of that crossover vibe to it that might sell.
I heard that the Honda E doesn't crash here. Like that it wouldn't. You know, they'd have to change it fundamentally for crash tests.
That's a pretty critical issue.
Yeah.
There's actually
25 years.
Right. There's also that Hyundai hatchback coming up, that like super angular thing that looks cool.
Oh yeah.
I forgot. 3 Series, probably convertible, about 20 years old. I would love one of those to run around town into. What's your next project car, John? Or what is your, you know, you're hinting at it. I feel like we do enough podcasts here, you're just going to feel the pressure to get one. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm thinking, you know, air-cooled Beetle.
Yeah.
And, you know, like a first generation Olds Tornado. That's been a car I've wanted since I was a child. I had a 442 for a while. I loved it, but I didn't love it enough to maintain it at the time. If it would have been a Tornado, I would have, you know, stuck with it. Because that's the one I really want.
That was, I believe, one of the first V8 front-wheel drive cars, if I'm getting my trivia things right.
That is correct.
Tornados were awesome. I loved those growing up. I don't know why I was so into them, but it was like, maybe it was the name kind of brought it in. Mm-hmm. And being a kid in the 80s, like there were still a lot of ones from the 60s still on the road. It wasn't like this dinosaur like it is now. So yeah, I'm with you. I've seen a couple of them at the Concours that we normally would have in town, usually this weekend. I believe it's called the Concours of America or something. It's what most people would know as Meadowbrook, even though they changed the name about 10 years ago. I saw like literally a Concours quality Tornado there, and I was like, oh my God. First of all, you're like, who does this to a Tornado? But it was pretty sweet. So yeah, I think Tornado is the next project car for the Snyder family. If I'm going to offer some prescriptive advice, I don't know. I'm already kind of looking forward to like going to M1 or something, you know, that Cars and Coffee thing they do out there at the track. Mm-hmm. It's free. Yeah. That seems fun.
Yeah. I know that now in my free time, I'm going to be looking up Tornados on eBay and Craigslist and bugging John to buy one.
Okay, go for it. I mean, anytime we do one of those posts, like what car would we get from such and such a decade? Like I mentioned that this Subaru SVX was one of them, and now everyone's sending me Subaru SVXs whenever they see them. But I actually have watch lists for Tornados that come into my inbox.
You can find some good stuff.
Send them my way.
You can find some good stuff on like. Really, it's weird because it's sort of like I've been looking at Chevelles just to see how much like the prices, what they range for the different years and different body styles between like Gen 2 and Gen 3. Because Gen 2 is obviously the iconic Chevelle, as well as the Oldsmobiles and, you know, the Pontiacs from that era, but in the Buicks. But it's interesting to look at like how it can be year by year and trim by trim. And then it's like, oh, what did XYZ seller decide to put it on? Bring a trailer, which is, you know, well, now it literally is like a car magazine almost. Mm-hmm. Or like Craigslist or some of these just random, like, you know, you just Google and it's like random dealer in Louisville has a Chevelle and you're like, all right, yeah, that's interesting. How did he get that car? That's kind of wild. But
I should mention though, if I'm being super realistic, the stopgap between now and getting an actual project car, I'm seriously considering getting a Honda Express moped from, you know, late 70s, early 80s. My brother-in-law has two of them and we were riding them around and it's just a blast. I grew up with one as a kid riding around our circle driveway, just putting like a couple hundred miles on it just in the driveway. And you know, you can get a decent one for, you know, $600-700. You might have to drive a little ways to pick it up, but you know, and you can get cool aftermarket parts for it. My brother-in-law put some badass exhaust on his, and I've got Kat maybe sort of somewhat convinced of that because it would you know, keep me from taking the plunge into, you know, the more expensive projects. It'd be a good stopgap.
Yeah.
Sounds like a pretty good good move, I would think. I mean, sounds pretty fun. Speaking of that, speaking of scooters, where's the Irby? Does anybody know where our like long-term air quotes scooter is that we've had for like 3 years and we apparently own it and I forgot about it?
I assume it's in the office.
I know. Byron was using it when he was moving for a little bit.
Oh yeah, he might still have it then.
Yeah.
Yeah, I kind of want to go get it. I have the Ridgeline. Which we'll probably talk about in a couple weeks, but I really like the Ridgeline. I'm gonna get some topsoil maybe tomorrow from Home Depot. I think I probably would go to the garden center at Home Depot, but if you do curbside pickup, they load it for you. So I think I'm just gonna do that. Slowly getting the backyard into shape since, you know, we kind of live out there during lockdown, so it's like you might as well. Like, I'm one of those guys who, once the calendar hits July, I'm like, it's fall. It's too late. I'm not going to do anything besides cut the grass.
Yeah.
This year, it's like, well, maybe not. You know, that's, look at it a different way. It's two more months of heat, and you're going to be out there. Might as well make it look good. I need to have a nice flower bed for when I'm sipping my, like, 9 o'clock, you know, white wine or beer or something like that on the patio. So we should probably whip through some news. What do you guys think?
Let's do it.
Probably.
All right. So the thought on the news segment was we were going to do news hits. Now that we've rambled for like 15 minutes on everything under the sun, we'll just keep them even tighter. So we'll do it that way. Basically, what I thought was kind of interesting this week, a little bit of just a news hit, was that the next generation Z, one, you know, Nissan's like, hey, it is happening. It's not going to be a hybrid or electric. So, I mean, okay, that is what it is. What I'm curious more than that, and that's just sort of like, I would say, a factoid that brings the car back into our radar. But how are you guys feeling about the future of the next gen Z car? For more context, check this whole story out. We put it up on the 20th, which was, I believe, Monday. Ronan Glahn wrote it. He's our European writer. Check the whole thing out as far as this story specifically. But how are you guys feeling, Z-Car?
Well, my thinking, with Alfonso Albaiza, you know, designing it, I feel pretty confident in that it's going to look cool. And from the things he's indicated in the past, it sounds like he's going to do it justice. As for the electrification, I get why they wouldn't do it right away. It could be one of those things where, you know, you don't want to botch the Z brand, if you will, by changing it too much from what it was originally intended to be. But you could, down the line, you know, like Mustang did, do a you know, Mustang Mach-E, like something with the Z name in it that isn't, you know, you're not diluting the purity of the actual Z car, but you can sort of add on to it in a different way. And then once people are open to that, maybe the next generation or something could be electric. But I would love to drive an electric Z car. I'm looking forward to the next Z car. I still love the current Z, as old as it feels. I kind of like it for that. It's pretty, I don't know, pretty raw.
Same here. I think the current Z car is actually pretty good for what it is. I like that feel. To me, it is like driving a press car from 2008, which it's not all that different.
I was going to say, it is a press car from 2008, basically.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, eventually they'll do it. I don't think it's a need to have right out of the gate. Joel, what do you think?
Well, I'm of two minds about the electrification, because on the one hand, I would really like to see like a cool, fast hybrid or electric car, because in part because there's so many like recent electric cars have been really kind of dorky and nerdy, and like I'd like something cool. Because I think there's a lot of potential in electric motors and hybrids to make a really cool sports car or sporty car. So I hope that it does happen eventually. I do also totally get that it'd be expensive and a bit of a risk to do that right now, and Nissan isn't necessarily in a position to do things super risky.
Right, good point.
On the plus side, if they're still sticking with kind of a more conventional powertrain, it gives me hope that there'll still be a manual transmission, which is becoming rarer and rarer day by day. So that would be nice to see. Regardless, based on the teasers that Nissan has shown, it looks like it's going to be a really sharp car, almost like kind of a budget Aston Martin. And I also can't wait for the Z to be updated, because unlike you guys, I mean, I can have fun in a Z, but boy, it is in dire need of an upgrade. It's not like the Frontier that, like, the bones are still good. Like, the Z's bones are fine, but there's just been so many things that have come out that have completely eclipsed it. And the interior, especially the infotainment, which is effectively non-existent in some of the more basic vehicles. I mean, it's a monochrome display, and like, it's just normal radio. There's no way to, like, to do a phone call, you have to like go through the voice system, and it's a huge hassle. And I mean, I'm sure there are sports car purists that are like, oh, quit your whining. Like, it's a sports car. You shouldn't be messing with your phone and things like that. But
if you're going to live with the car, you know, you want to be able to
exactly
have those conveniences.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's fair too. I mean, I would say this too. I don't think the car handles all that great anymore either. In 08, 09, it did for its class and its time. I think now, I mean, it's pretty old. And I think they've done some things to keep it, you know, still a performance-oriented machine, if you will, to use that cliche. But I don't know. I still enjoy it, but it's tricky. Let's put it that way. And when you benchmark it against really anything, you've really got to buy the car right now for how it looks, which is entirely reasonable. It's a beautiful car. But I mean, when you look at what Ford's doing with the Mustang, the Camaro is so sophisticated with its, you know, the engineering, the chassis, you know, work they've done on that car. It's, you know, there's no comparison.
And both of those cars give you a lot more for a lot less money.
Yep, absolutely. So speaking of not much money, Honda's Fit, done. That's a riff on the headline. The Fit is go from like, again, 10, 12 years ago. I would pour one out for the Honda Fit. I thought it was a fun car to drive. I thought it looked, you know, it was cute. I thought the manual was pretty good. It was like a joystick manual transmission. The clutch was so dead that like, and that was fine. It was fun. It was like an economy, like standard transmission, if you will. I really like this car. I'm literally one of the few Americans that probably was still thinking, hey, there's a place for it, but sorry, it's history.
I'm really bummed about this one. I adore the Honda Fit. My friend Christian, shout out, just bought a used Fit with a manual transmission. He is a fairly recent driver, and so the manual transmission's new to him. I'm like, dude, you're spoiled. That's a really good transmission. This is a car that I have suggested to people who are looking to buy a new car and ask for my advice, and they actually followed up on the advice, and they loved it. You know, it's got so much charm. I'm sad to see it go, especially with the new hybrid version coming out on the global markets. I was really looking forward to hopefully getting that here, but now my dreams are crushed.
You could put so many things in this. We had a long-term Honda Fit at Auto Week, and we had it for a really long time. It was surprisingly durable. One of my editors hit a deer with it, and it still came back. The deer, ironically, was in like Las Vegas or Nevada. It wasn't in Michigan, which is crazy. You'd think this is the place you're more likely to, you know, pick off a deer. But it came back better than ever. I remember one Christmas I had it, and I put literally gifts for my entire extended family in there. Like, everybody. You put the seats down. I couldn't believe how much stuff you got in there. The downside, it's a little scary to drive on the expressway. You know, it's a small car. Sometimes it feels more like you're sailing than anything else. I think it's actually a pretty good city car in places like, I always go back to this, Quebec City. Like, it's a North American city that does feel like you're in France. So it's kind of like the best of both worlds. It's like European, but also you're here still, essentially. and the streets are very tight. They're very old. People mm-hmm. drive Echo Sports. They drive Honda Fits. They put snow tires on them. They do things.
Smart cars.
Yeah, they do. You know, what's the Mercedes, the smaller, the old B-Class. And I mean, the Fit works in places like that, where you don't need this like smart car go-kart, but you don't obviously need a Chevy Tahoe. And in the United States, we don't really do a lot in between for like, you know, congested areas. And the Fit was great for that. So, Joel, did you ever drive a Fit? What do you think?
Yeah, So I'm sad it's going away. Because like you guys said, it had monumental amounts of space. And it was fun to drive, legitimately. It handled really well with the manual transmission. It was sporty and fun. They looked good, too. And like the new generation looks especially good. On the flip side, it's like, we all knew that this was going to happen at some point. Because, no, people just don't buy these cars anymore. Yeah. They buy the crossover equivalents of them. And Honda has the HR-V, which even has the same fancy magic seat in the back that flips up and flips down and all around. And it also has a little more power, too. And while the new Fit looks really good and the hybrid would be neat, I worry that it wouldn't be as fun to drive because they're not offering it with a manual anywhere. It's CVT only, or whatever their like electronic CVT system is.
The automatic whatever CVT really is not nearly as fun as the manual in this car.
Right, obviously. Right. And so in some ways, I feel like the Fit with a manual was what I loved. The Fit with a CVT, I kind of take it or leave it. So, I mean, yeah, I'm sad it's going away, but it makes complete and total sense. Nobody's buying them, especially not with a manual transmission. Everybody's buying little bitty crossovers, Konas and HRVs and Echo Sports and things like that, because people want something that looks tall and rugged, and the Fit was not that.
It was a far better vehicle for its purpose than the Honda HR-V, which I believe, Joel, correct me if I'm wrong, it's the same chassis.
Yeah, I think they're closely related, but they've got different engines. The HR-V, I think, has a version of an older Honda Civic engine.
Mm. All right, well, that's enough about the Fit. The Fit is done. Mercedes has a electric vehicle called the EQS. It's coming up. We have, essentially this week, we got confirmation of the range, which is 435 miles. I was at the Frankfurt Motor Show, 5 years ago now, when they first announced this, at least 5 years ago, when they sort of announced the EQ program. This is really Mercedes's, green efforts, if you will, to, you know, bring that technology to a variety of cars in its lineup. We tested, the EQ technology is already available in some of its cars in more limited applications. But this is like the full-on Tesla fighting sort of, you know, car, as opposed to using some light, you know, regenerative or recuperative or assistive technology and like one element of the powertrain. This is like, look out Tesla, here comes Mercedes, if you will. So I am very excited about this vehicle from that perspective. I think the range could be very intriguing, and I think it it's what Mercedes needs to do. The only issue I have is I'm a little confused by the name. EQS is something that I constantly have to go back and like, what is that car again? What is it? But yeah, I mean, Mr. Green Editor, what do you think?
I'm really looking forward to this car. I love that, there's going to be sort of another sedan that's maybe a good cross-shopper to the Tesla Model S. I think at 435 miles, that's on the WLTP European cycle. So even if it's, around 400 miles of range here, that's a lot. That's a a lot. And you know, if you can get a car like that with Mercedes interior of all things, that's going to look pretty nice compared to the Tesla Model S. The Tesla Model S will always have its fans, and it's always going to be, you know, sort of the benchmark, and it's got crazy performance. But I've just loved every sort of Mercedes of this latest generation that's come out. And I have yet to drive an all-electric Mercedes. You know, I haven't driven the EQC or anything, but I'll be curious to see how good this electric powertrain is. And that's sort of the mystery figure of this formula. If that's good, I'm going to love this car.
Joel, any quick thoughts on this?
Yeah, I'm excited about it. Based on like spy shots and the concept, they look very similar. And I think it's a really neat shape. It's a very curvy, organic shape that kind of runs counter to traditional Mercedes styling, which is very conservative and a little bit more squared off. So I'm excited to see it come out. And like John was saying, Mercedes interiors are pretty much top of the heap. It doesn't get much better than that. And it'll be neat to see like an ultra luxury electric car finally. Tesla has kind of played in that market, but their interior quality, like not even necessarily fit and finish, but just design and materials are not as nice as Mercedes can do. So it'll be neat to see what Mercedes does with that. And the range is
sounds good.
Amazing.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It sounds good, and I'm pretty psyched about that. I mean, this is, I'll use another cliche, game-changing. You know, I mean, you get that kind of range, I mean, that's going to really be, you know, game-changing, life-changing for some people, because yeah, you could do a lot of things with that kind of a range. It's not like a 30-mile-an-hour range or 30-mile range. It's like, hey, I can drive to my cottage. Hey, I can drive to work all week, you know, that sort of thing. So we'll leave it there. How about an electric Humvee? Let's lob that one right at you. We'll lob it, you know, as a, I guess, a grenade, a good analogy, because it could be, you know, it's would be for military applications. I should say this, it's GMC's electric Hummer that then could be used, you know, along with like defense vehicles like the Humvee. It's kind of an interesting little, like, you know, inside baseball story. I think it makes a ton of sense. I think it would make a lot of sense on military bases where maybe you drive around in like Jeep-like vehicles and they're already kind of self-contained. So there you go. I mean, I don't know as much as how it would work necessarily, say, in the field. You certainly would, you know, you can't recharge your GMC Hummer on the front lines, but you know, obviously they'd figure that out. So, I don't know, it's kind of cool. Neat story.
Yeah. I'd be curious to see, you know, it's not going to be like the Humvee at all. This is more like, I'd put it more on par with a Chevy Suburban or something. It's kind of that size and shape. The one I saw at the GM EV Day was very tall, and you know, pretty rugged looking. It looks like it could do a lot. I don't know about if it could do any of the stuff a Humvee. They would have to do some changes to it to use it in the field. But it's big. It could carry a lot of people. As it is now, you know, you can take the roof off. I'm sure there's a lot of modularity built into this. Into this body, that would make it very useful. Definitely like you said, around bases and whatnot would be a good fit. I'm curious. Yeah. I know GM's been working with the military for a long time with fuel cell technology. This might be, the answer that they've actually been looking for.
Yeah, there's some interesting potential there. Certainly, they would be a lot cheaper to run and operate, since You don't have to worry about diesel fuel. You don't have to worry about maintaining them, oil changes, filter changes, things like that. Not having to worry about having to adapt the powertrain necessarily as much. I mean, got to have snorkels and high-quality air filters for going through water and dealing with dusty situations, right. And that's probably not as big an issue for an electric motor and batteries. I could see initial cost being kind of an issue. Well, actually, who knows? The military seems to have like unlimited budget to spend on whatever they want, so maybe that's not a big issue. I suppose armoring them could be a little bit difficult, and some new considerations with like the battery, especially having it on the floor, could be a really vulnerable area, especially with like improvised explosive devices and things. And you don't really want a lithium ion battery to catch fire.
Yeah. also the fact that you could use it, you know, to power equipment, electrical equipment out in the field. You know, I wouldn't want it on the front lines, but you could, you know, if you needed to set up some sort of array or something, or do some work, build something, you know, you can tap into that battery power to power tools and whatnot, which is kind of cool.
Mm-hmm, for sure. It's probably not something that you'd want to take on like a long remote mission, no. Just because it's easier to bring with you a whole bunch of tanks of diesel than it is to necessarily bring charging equipment or like solar panels that could adequately keep the vehicle charged. Right. But for less remote missions, and also, I mean, just running between bases and things here in the States, probably would make a lot of sense. And I mean, GM can build a military vehicle. They just recently got a contract for that like mid-size pickup truck type thing with the military that's based on the Colorado ZR2.
Okay.
So pretty cool stuff. I think the ZR2 based vehicle is, you know, I think we've seen some sketches or something on that. They've kind of sort of teased that one out. That's pretty cool. And I mean, sounds more like this electric Hummer would be more like maybe a National Guard sort of vehicle in some ways. Like you're running around like, you know, stateside duties versus, mm-hmm. you know, overseas, but who knows? We'll see. It's kind of cool.
Yeah. Actually, now that you mention it, that could be great for like Coast Guard or Army Corps engineers, yeah. like going to disaster areas. Because
yeah. yeah.
it's something that would basically function as a generator.
Yeah, yeah. That's brilliant.
All right, Joel, I just promote you to Major General. You are in charge of the electric fleet of Hummers for regenerative, we'll say, like, dam building or something. sounds like a project from, you know, FDR would have probably come up with.
Yeah.
So, what about the Kia K5? To totally do a hard fade, what'd you do with that? it's a pretty important new car for Kia. You got to do a drive of that. What'd you think, man?
Yeah, so I had two K5s for a couple of days. I had a kind of high-level EX and also a sporty-looking GT line. And we'll have all the details in a full review in the near future. But as for kind of a quick rundown, I was pretty impressed overall. It's a really cool-looking car, especially in person. You can really appreciate a lot of the neat details, like the aggressive nose and the detailed grille, the neat full-width taillights. It's got lots of really nice design details that really pop out when you see it in person. The interior is really nice, too. It's got kind of this dual-level dashboard where your controls and stuff kind of sit on a lower section that kind of sticks out a little bit. And then you've got the screen on top of that, and then you've got the rest of the dashboard behind that. And it's got really nice plastics and materials. The EX that I had, it was a fake wood trim, and you can kind of tell that, but it still looked really nice. It had kind of a natural finish to it that's kind of modern and high-end looking. Like most Kias, I mean, you can get a really comfortable driving position because you've got lots of adjustment in the steering wheel and the seats. And actually, the seats themselves are really comfortable. Some of the more comfortable Kia seats I've been in, like really thickly cushioned, bolstered seats that just kind of, it's a gentle hug when you step in. It's got lots of space. You sit up a little bit high. I like sitting lower because that's me, but I know that a lot of people that like crossover and stuff would appreciate the slightly higher seating position. On the road, it's super, super quiet. The ride quality is excellent. It's this nice supple ride that it irons out of the bumps, but you're not disconnected from the road. Like, you still know everything that's going on. You're not going to get seasick from kind of a floaty feeling, but it's very, very comfortable. Really, the only downside is that if you are looking for kind of a sporty, fun-to-drive sedan, you should skip this and go for, like, an Accord or a Mazda 6. Okay. It's not eager to turn in. It has a decent amount of body roll. It feels a little heavy and slow to react. It's not a great handling vehicle. I'm hoping that that's rectified with the, like, 290 horse GT model that comes out a little later. And as for the engine in this, it's the turbocharged 1.6 liter engine. It's only like 190 some horsepower, but it feels totally adequate. Like, it doesn't feel slow. It's got good low down torque, so it's comfortable to drive around. It's not a rocket, but you're not going to be left behind. And it has a transmission in it. Again, it's really smooth. It's just not very fast. So it's not an enthusiast car, but it's super stylish. It's super comfortable. And I'd rank it high on the list. I think Accord is still the king overall. But this would be probably a close second or third.
It's a nice breakdown. I would be tough, because I really like the Accord, to, if I were actually buying one of these, to go with that over, or to go with the K5 over the Accord. But it's intriguing. This car got a lot of publicity when it was sort of announced and then almost simultaneously driven, which was kind of an interesting rollout a few weeks back. I think it looks amazing. Powertrains are interesting. Yeah, I mean, Kia's been taking some risks and largely pulling them off. So we'll see. Stay tuned. So you also had a good time in the Mini Cooper GP, which stands for Grand Prix, as I was trying to get all of those syllables out. That's a fun car. I didn't drive this one, but I have driven them in the past. Tell us about this, and what did you do with it?
Yeah, so again, just kind of driving around normally, but I've got sort of a little in-town loop that takes me on some curvy on-ramps and things, and that I can actually kind of enjoy a car on. And the Mini GP, it is such a ridiculous little thing. In some ways, it's not, like, it's got issues, but on the whole, I had a whole lot of fun with it. It is so loud and so harsh. It's and it's loud, not necessarily in a good way. Because this car, like, they got a whole lot out of it. They take out the rear seat, and they took out a whole bunch of other, like, little things just here and there. Like, it doesn't have a rear wiper. It only has, so unlike normal Minis, it has front visors for the front windshield and then side ones for the side windows, since the windshield is kind of far ahead of you. But they got rid of the side ones in this, just as, like, one other little thing that they took out to make it lighter. No spare tire. But they also took out lots and lots of sound deadening. And so on the highway, it's just so much engine and wind and tire and road noise just all the time. It's relentless. And the suspension is so, it, like, there aren't a lot of cars that I've had to describe as having hard suspension, but this has hard suspension. It feels like it doesn't have any at all. It just bounces you around all over the place. But on the flip side, like, the thing handles like a slot car. It just goes right where you want it to. It responds instantly. There's no body roll at all. And it grips and grips and grips. So you can just drive it harder and harder and harder. And all those weight and all that weight savings, sees benefits in that it also has a really powerful engine. It's got the turbo 2 liter from the John Cooper Works Clubman and Countryman. So it's 301 horsepower and like just over 330 pound feet of torque. And like all of that torque is just available anywhere in the rev band. So it just takes off, and it only weighs about 2,800 pounds, which is about the same as a regular Mini Cooper S, except with an extra 100 horsepower.
Yeah.
So it's a little rocket, and boy, you can feel the torque through the steering wheel. It's been a while since I've driven something with so much torque steer. Like you floor it, and that wheel is just wiggling back and forth, and it's exciting. Like all of this lack of refinement, it's not objectively good, but I kind of missed driving something that was sort of this uncouth and unrefined.
Like, right. It reminds me, the last time I drove, you know, a JCW or something, it was, there was a lot of torque steer. And then, if you hit any rough roads or bumps in a turn, this thing, you know, wants to skip on you. So it's really sort of a riot just keeping this thing reined in. And it can be kind of exhausting, but it, like you said, it's very exciting. And I can't imagine what this is like. It'd be really interesting to take this over some of the rough potholed corners with seams and whatnot, accelerating through a turn. Mm-hmm. That'd be quite the experience, I imagine.
Yeah. And it's also kind of funny on this one, like on most minis, like you have a little switch to change your drive mode and it kind of changes your steering and suspension and things. This doesn't have anything like that. It has one mode. The nice. Only thing that you can change is you can reduce the amount of traction control and you can have the transmission shift a little sportier. But there's nothing to change your steering or suspension. It's just, it is what it is, and you either like it or you don't. And I, for the most part, liked it. And on the note of that transmission, yes, it only comes with an automatic transmission, which is... it's a bummer, and it's not the best automatic in the world. I mean, there are better DCTs and things out there, but it's still not a bad transmission. Like, it didn't get in the way of me having a lot of fun. And something that I do like about it is they gave it these really neat aluminum paddle shifters, and they're 3D printed aluminum.
Oh, cool.
And they feel actually really nice.
That's kind of neat.
Mm-hmm.
That is a very kind of cool little Easter egg, if you will. I think minis are something that I didn't necessarily, you know, growing up in Michigan, you don't see a ton of them. But to me, they're almost like a press car treat, which sounds kind of like, you know, kind of weird. But I mean, it's a car that like once I really got into a few, you know, all sorts of different minis, actually. Really got into understanding what the brand is, dove into the history, the heritage of it. I went on a mini press trip one time. That's what you really like, almost can't, like, it's like eating ice cream, you know, they're so much fun. You know, I love your slot car analogy there, Joel. That's, you know, go-karts, you know, whatever. Yeah. They're a ton of fun. They're so much fun. And they're, you know, they're pretty raw. They're not for everybody, but I mean, just for like the steering, the, you know, the way they handle. I'll say this too. I know the fact that they only come with automatic, or this one only, you know, is offered with an automatic. You know, I don't know. I like the whole idea of having a mini with a manual for sure, but I've never thought their manual transmissions were especially special. They're good. Right. They're fine, but it's not like, you know, certain Mazdas, I think, just have such, you know, amazing manual transmissions, certain Hondas, you know, even, you know, the GTIs, I think, is pretty good. There's a few like benchmark manual transmissions where I'm like, man, if that car didn't have that transmission, I would be sad. I don't generally put Mini into that category.
Yeah, and something I will say, some of the Mini GP's competition is, on the whole, significantly better. The Civic Type R and the Veloster N, all around much better packages, and on the whole, better driving. But this Mini does offer a really unique driving experience that I think absolutely has merit. And if you're looking for just a raw, unfiltered, like, hyper-engaging car, this is it.
Very cool. Let's move on, I guess, right? Any other thoughts on either of those cars there, Joel, before I do move on?
I don't think so.
Okay. Sounds like you had a pretty pretty enjoyable week as far as, driving a couple of interesting, engaging vehicles, which are, I think, that's what you want to do right now. Sort of in this, kind of quasi-quarantine. Driving cars is a lot of fun. You can get out, you can, just forget about everything else, listen to some music and, think about the car. So, cool. Good stuff. Check out those reviews. The K5's coming. Is the Mini coming as well, or is that's already up, Joel?
Mini should be out in a day or two from the time of recording.
All right.
Just finished building it out today.
Sounds good. So if you're listening to this podcast over the weekend, I'll give you my standard, what you could be doing over the weekend on the patio, walking the dog, hauling some mulch, whatever it is you're doing, break up the podcast because, hey, we're already running quite long. This is three straight weeks of really long podcasts. But, come back to Autoblog. Check out that review. And then let's move along to a new segment. So far, during the quarantine, we've been coming up with, random segments for the podcast. I think it's because, we're not all in the office recording these together where we have more of a structured format. With this, it's like, well, hey, what random thing should we talk about? And this week I came up with one called Love It or Hate It. My, I'd say, point of contention is the 1966 Pontiac GTO. I'm curious, do you guys love it or hate it? And for some further context here, I didn't pick that year out of thin air. 66 was the year the GTO became sort of its own Pontiac model. It was not, part of, under an earlier model, which is cool. I think it was the Tempest, correct me if I'm wrong. This was its own car, the GTO. This is also the year that it had those famous stacked headlights. And it really became, I think, sort of into its own as this iconoclast muscle car that really, I think, to me, this is polarizing. Maybe I'm kind of got to get on my own way here, but to me, this was a car that was polarizing. Some people love them, some people hate them. Regardless, it's one of the, seminal muscle cars of the 60s. I don't think there's any argument there. Definitely a boulevard cruiser, something that could win a lot of battles at stoplights. Do you love it or do you hate this model of the GTO? Let's go with you, John.
Both. growing up, I was never a fan of it. But as I've grown older, I've come to appreciate it more and more. The looks, especially. And I also appreciate what it was doing for GM at the time, which was creating competition among the brands. The Oldsmobile versus Pontiac rivalry was strong, and they were trying to outdo each other with performance and design. And while I would definitely myself prefer something of the Cutlass variety, you can't take away the legacy of this car. It's just really something. Although I've always thought, moving on to the next generation, I've always thought that the Judge was super cool. I don't know why, but I love the Judge. But yeah, the 66, I think, is a better looking car than that. Just it still has some more of those old classic car sort of silhouette and lines. The face is a little funky with the stacked headlights, but I like that. And it was before it started to, you know, bulk up and before it like went to the gym and gained that new body. I think it looks really good. I haven't driven one, and I would love to if someone has one and wants to let me drive it. But yeah, so I love what it did. My favorite thing about it is just what it stands for in that time in GM, and which was competition for the betterment of all the brands.
Well said. Well said. Joel, you challenged the entire premise that this vehicle was controversial. What do you think?
Yeah, when I saw Love It or Hate It 1966 GTO, my reaction was, really? Because I was just like, does anybody find this controversial? I've never in my life thought or heard somebody say that this version of the GTO was controversial. And I mean, whenever I looked at it, I was like, oh, that's a really cool car. I like what they did with like the big, and I mean, while we were attributed to BMW, it's basically got a twin kidney grill. And I like the headlights. I guess I never thought having them stacked up like that would be considered very weird. In profile, it's really clean and lean. And it's kind of just as the GTO was starting to get a little bit of that quote-unquote Coke bottle side treatment, where it's a little bit thicker around the wheels, and like it dips down right around the doors and then tapers off at the end. I've always thought it was really good looking, and I always figured it was much later, like mid to late 70s GTOs that were kind of the derided ones. Whereas, I mean, this is basically the second generation GTO and the first one to be like its own model. I figured it was thoroughly and unanimously loved, but I guess I'm wrong. I don't know. As for like later ones, I like them too. I think this is probably the leanest looking one. The later ones started getting a little wider. The body started to spill a little over the wheels a little bit more than they used to. Again, I think those look good too. I like that they're even more exaggerated and aggressive, but I liked this one too. I didn't think anybody had an issue with it.
So maybe it's a little bit of a straw man argument where you kind of make up an argument then debate it. But I'll say this. Where I'm coming from this is I feel like this was obviously it had amazing acceleration. It didn't handle so well, but frankly, some of those things in the 60s didn't handle well. Let's put it that way. Including some of those like iconic earlier Chevelles from like 68 to 72. As I lay this out here, my argument is that the GTO, as opposed to say a Charger or some of the other muscle cars of that era, the Mustang, later than the Camaro, those cars seem to be more, I would say, universally accepted for what they are. Call me crazy here, but the GTO was not immediately maybe accepted for what it was because it was so polarizing. Maybe profane was a word I used off off camera or whatever we're doing here. But to bring it all together, I like it. It wouldn't be my choice if you were like, Greg, here's $100,000. Pick your favorite car from 1960 to 70. Wouldn't be my choice. I feel like there's other cars that, while perhaps less iconic, are, I'd just rather have them, you know? They're cooler for different reasons. I do like the looks, but I can see why that, like, you know, you referenced some of the styling cues, the Coke bottle, like, elements, the headlights. Some people think it's a bit much. They think the car is, yeah. But it's also one of those things where, like, maybe the farther away you get from 1966, you forget, like, what some people used to think, like, of the car back then, and it just goes back into this kind of famous vintage classic car. And that's where it fades away and you forget some of the criticism. So looks like we have two like-its and three like-its, really. So
I don't know. Yeah, I mean, nowadays it's hard to argue against it. I could see back in the day how you could start a fight over it, but maybe not so much anymore.
All right. Well, coming up right now, we have an interview. Again, senior producer Chris McGraw spoke with Jimmy Chin. He is the Oscar award-winning filmmaker who created those short films, commercials that you watched a couple of weeks back for the reveal of the Bronco. Really interesting piece. Let's listen in.
Today, I get the privilege to be able to talk with Jimmy Chin, professional climber, photographer, Oscar award-winning filmmaker, who collaborated with Disney Creative Works and Ford to co-create the three network reveal stories about the Ford Bronco. If you haven't seen the videos yet, you can check out the link below in the description or in the article on autoblog.com. And also make sure to check out all of the Bronco coverage on Autoblog as well. Jimmy, thanks for taking the time to talk to me today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me on the show.
I guess let's just get right into it. How did you get involved with the Ford Bronco on this project?
Well, Ford came to me to talk about, you know, putting together a few films on the relaunch of the Bronco. And, you know, obviously I knew it was a huge opportunity. I'm very excited about it. But, you know, with any sort of project that gets, you know, this kind of attention, there's also, you know, a lot of pressure. So fortunately, that's a space that I spend a lot of time in. You know, it's like the classic feeling on an expedition where you're really motivated to climb something, whether that's in the Himalayas or around the world. But there's also that nervous energy of like, okay, we really gotta step up and make this great. But Ford's been an incredible partner to work with, and we had some really talented people, and we just dove into it and wanted to do something that was special.
I would say, like, normally your subjects are human beings, which I think still rings true with the three videos that you produced here. But I was just curious if there are any unique challenges that shooting a car brought to the production that perhaps maybe you haven't encountered before.
Well, I mean, I think that what we were really trying to achieve here was just to, A, tell a great story. You know, we had obviously great talent. Kip Moore, really successful and amazing country musician. Brooke Rabatou, who is, you know, representing the U.S. in the Olympics as a climber. And then myself. But I think the idea behind these films was really related to, you know, what the Bronco was representing in this moment. A vehicle that could, like, really get you back outdoors to reconnect with the wild places. And all three of us, the characters in each of these films, have, like, a really special relationship with the outdoors. You know, we found a lot of inspiration in the outdoors. Kip, you know, has, you know, he's not just a great musician, but he's actually a great climber, a great surfer, you know, finds a lot of inspiration in the outdoors for his music. Brooke was, you know, grew up climbing outdoors. That's where her love for the outdoors came from, traveling with her family on climbing trips. And then for me, it was also, obviously, I spend a lot of time in the mountains and in the outdoors. It's a really important muse for a lot of my work. So, you know, it was really kind of combining these stories and telling, you know, each person's story, but also tying in how the Bronco, in a lot of ways, you know, is able to get us to the places that we love.
Definitely, yeah. Before I... like when I got the one line email of like what each of these videos were about, I could definitely take a guess at how your personal branding would come through on both your video and Brooke's video. But personally, not being as familiar with Kip Moore, I was curious to see how your personal branding would come out on that video. Obviously, once watching the video, was very clear. I mean, with these three videos, they could take your name out of the titles and people familiar with your work would know that this is a Jimmy Chin collaboration, at least in my opinion. How do you...
Thank you.
How do you kind of balance keeping your personal branding consistent as well as staying on message for brands and companies that your work is highlighting? Do you just only accept work from, you know, brands that you care about and speak to you?
Sure. I mean, I am very discerning about the people that I work with and the brands that I work with. You know, the Bronco for me was a natural fit. So, and I think it's such an iconic vehicle and it's such, it's got such great heritage. You know, for me, that is exactly the type of, you know, partner I want. It just really makes it a lot easier for me to do the work because it's real and it's authentic. I don't have to try too hard.
Right.
It just made sense to me. But, you know, when I think about the kind of work I aspire to do, it's really about kind of telling human stories, you know, that have like a universal thread. And I think that, you know, with Kip and Brooke and myself, a lot of people see the success of the careers, but they might not necessarily appreciate how hard it was to get there, the sacrifices you have to make, the grit, the hard work that goes into it. And that process of getting to where we have all gotten to is, you know, so important, but also, you know, oftentimes when you get to the place you're going to, it's because you've loved the process of getting there. You've had to embrace the hard work and the challenges to get there. And that to me was a really, you know, good metaphor for the Bronco, because this is the vehicle that, you know, can handle all the challenges on, you know, a very potentially hard road to getting to where you want to get to. And that was how I was thinking about it, is like crafting those two stories so that we didn't have to be overtly constantly being like, this is the vehicle that will get you there. I wanted people to feel it.
Right. Yeah. Now you're probably best known for directing Free Solo, but your personal achievements are incredibly impressive as well. You're part of the first team to summit Meru. You skied off the summit of Mount Everest, crossed the Changtong Plateau on foot, carrying everything behind you. Yeah, I read Rick Ridgway's book.
Oh, no way.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
Yeah, I love that book. I'm working through like all of his right now. I've got two left.
He's a great mentor of mine. He's the one actually that taught me to film. And if you watch any of my films in the acknowledgements and thank yous in the back, he's always very high on that list of thank yous. So.
Was that trip, the Changtong Plateau, I hope I'm pronouncing
yeah,
that right.
Right.
Was that like your first, that was one of your first like video trips, right?
Yes, that's actually the trip that, you know, kind of started me off as a filmmaker. And Rick literally, if you read the book, you know,
yeah.
I'd never filmed before that trip, really. And he was the one that said, you know, look, I know you haven't filmed before. Just commit and figure it out. And he basically mentored me for a few months while I was making that film, and then came back after the trip and really worked with me on crafting the story. And that's how I got started. And it was a big breakthrough expedition for me, because that's how I got my foot in the door at National Geographic. And that was the first time I published images in the National Geographic magazine, which as a photographer, as you know, is
right.
Dream.
Yeah, definitely. I guess like along those lines, most of your outdoors achievements are probably considered human powered. What kind of role have cars played in your life growing up and even now?
I mean, You know, I think I mentioned it in the film, like when I finished college, I moved into my car and lived on the road for over 7 years. And, you know, the open road for me really represented freedom, and especially for me in the like the American West. Like some of my fondest memories, you know, that like kind of create that sense of nostalgia, is just driving down the big open roads of the West, sometimes not exactly knowing where I'm going, but just out for an adventure. And I think, you know, like the Bronco really embodies that spirit for me, because it's like, it's about going on an adventure, going on to less explored parts of the country. It gives you that access. And so, I mean, I've spent a lot of time on the road, you know, going to the places that I love going to climb or to ski. And I actually really appreciate that time in the car. Sometimes it's with your friends having great conversations. Sometimes it's just listening to music, driving down the road by yourself, just being reflective on life. And so I guess you could say it's been a big part of my life.
Your next major project is a documentary about Doug and Chris Tompkins and the work that they've done along with Yvonne Chouinard down in Patagonia. Doug, who founded the North Face, He and Yvonne and three other guys drove a Ford Econoline in 1968 from California down to Patagonia, surfing and mountain climbing and all that along the way.
I'm so impressed, by the way, with how much you know. I was thinking the auto blog. I'm like, okay, cool. But you've done your homework.
Thank you. I appreciate that very much. How do you think the Bronco would fare on a trip like that? And do you have any plans to replicate that trip in a Ford Bronco?
Oh man, that would be a dream trip. I think the Ford Bronco would be the perfect vehicle. You know, I mean, especially back when they did it, I mean, I bet they were driving down roads that you wouldn't really even consider roads.
Especially in a van today, yeah.
Yeah, down through Central America and down along the coast of South America. I mean, it's kind of considered, you know, the ultimate a road trip. So, yeah, you'd want a vehicle that could handle a lot. Sure.
I just have a couple more questions here. This one more about climbing and how it's becoming a little more mainstream. I was able to film Alex Honnold talking about Rivian last year at an event out here in Denver. And now with your involvement with the Ford Bronco, there seems to be quite a bit of crossover between climbing and outdoor athletes and cars. In the 20 plus years that you've been a professional climber, what are some of the changes that you've seen and experienced now that climbing is getting more popular and is being brought into the mainstream?
Yeah, I mean, some people say that I'm responsible for some of that.
I would agree with those people.
Sounds like there's been quite an uptick since Free Solo came out. But, you know, I think climbing is such a great, you know, activity. It's great individually. I think, you know, it's something that you do that really forces you to be present and in the moment. There's a lot of, you know, obviously the physical challenges, but there's also the mental challenges. You have to be, you know, have a kind of adventurous spirit and want to have like that kind of space in your life, but it's also very introspective and like, you know, you're managing your own fears. You have to push through those fears. It's a process of kind of failure and redemption. You know, you're always trying routes that are just a little too hard for you. You fail on them and then you have to improve in order to do the climb and you kind of cycle through that process over and over again. And I think that that's a good experience to have. And it's also great, I think, to be able to, you know, spend time with your friends, and it's a great social activity too. So I think it, like, people have really embraced that, and, you know, it's a non-traditional kind of sport. When I started, it was kind of a very fringe activity. I think it's great, because it gets people, especially if you want to climb in the mountains or outside, you know, it gets people outdoors, which I think is great, because, you know, I think that when you spend time in the outdoors and you really appreciate the outdoors, and you, there are places around that you climb in, that your local crags that you really fall in love with or are meaningful to you. I always believe that you take care of the things that you love. And so in a way, it's kind of a good step for people to, you know, pay attention to the environment and, you know, hopefully get to a place where they want to protect and preserve the environment. So I think it's great.
Yeah, I would agree. I moved from Michigan to Colorado a couple of years ago, and the one reason that we ended up where we were is proximity to the mountains and proximity to a climbing gym. That was my wife and I's two main concerns.
So. Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, finally, while we have you here, since you're an award-winning photographer, I'd like to show you three automotive photos and have you do like a quick 30 to 60 second critique of each.
Are these yours?
These are mine, yeah.
First, I have to say that just the curation tells me a lot. You know, it's these three photos are very different, which also different color palette, different kind of focal length. So I can tell you've been thoughtful about the pictures that you've chosen. Chose a good diversity of imagery, but obviously the first one is great. Shows the vehicle, but also highlights the context of what this road trip was potentially for you. Beautiful sunset, hard to beat that. Great light. Yeah. Love the reflection on the vehicle. Well composed, perfectly composed. The second photo is great. A little tighter. A little more focused on the main subject here, center punch the subject. Love the depth of field. You clearly using some nice glass, nice lenses there, but no mistaking. Kind of like, this is the subject. It's going through some rough terrain. So, you know, the thing about photography is like when I see photos like this, I can tell that you've been very intentional in how you've shot it. These aren't kind of happy accidents that have happened. So that's a great shot. And love that third shot as well. Big landscape context. And then like the subtle hint of the vehicle in the lower right-hand corner on a big curvy road. You know, it emits a feeling, which is hard to do in photos. That's what you're always trying to do. So great job. Clearly you've been doing a lot of shooting.
Quite a bit, yeah. Thank you very much.
These are great.
Thank you.
Really impressed.
That was it for me today. Thanks for taking the time today, Jimmy. It's been a pleasure.
Absolutely. Thank you. And hopefully we get to meet in person sometime, Chris.
All right. Thanks, Jimmy. Thanks, Chris. Really interesting interview. Hope you guys have a chance to go back and watch some of those videos again. And of course, check out all of your Bronco coverage on your favorite website on autoblog.com. So it's time to spend some money. This is a pretty interesting email. It's pretty long. You guys ready for this?
Yeah.
All right. Sounds good. So our writer is, let's see, he says he's going to share a shock top with us during the podcast. It's almost 5 o'clock here on the East Coast time. I kind of like shock tops. I think they're pretty good. That's Budweiser's sort of wheat beer. They were really popular about 10 years ago. Don't see as many of them as the craft beer phase is really, I think, just overwhelmed everything. But yeah, I could go for a shock top, maybe with an orange peel in it. Sounds pretty good. So He's looking to buy a car in the next month or so. Background is from South Africa, moved to the UK, and was due to relocate to New York, except for this crazy thing called the coronavirus. So he's had a bunch of different cars. Let me just try and rip through a few of them. When he was living in South Africa, he drove a 1980 VW Golf 1 diesel pickup. Oh my gosh, that's amazing. Yeah. An 86 Mazda 323, 1990 Jetta, 1990 Mazda 323, another Jetta, a Mazda, another Mazda, a 2004 Clio, that was the hatch. Then when he relocated to the UK, he drove an 04 Mondeo. This is the 2.0 with the manual. That's kind of neat. An 08 Mondeo. I don't honestly even know what car this is here. It's a 2.0 with a Ghia Auto. Would you guys tell me what that is while I'm going through this?
Well, so we never got that generation of Mondeo, I don't think. Okay. Well, actually, 2004. Well, we definitely didn't get the 2008.
Right.
2004, I'm trying to think if... Was the Ford Contour still around at that point? Because that was...
So that's what's tripping me up, is I don't remember when and where the Contour went away.
Yeah.
I honestly don't remember either.
So... No, wait, 2004. No, I think that was a newer generation Mondeo. So we never got either of those. But the current Fusion is also the Mondeo in Europe. And obviously we're not going to get another generation of that here. Europe will probably get a new Mondeo though. But yeah, it's Ford of Europe's midsize sedan.
All right. I'll buy that. Well, I wouldn't buy that, but I'll agree with that premise. So the budget is, and he also owned a Kia Sportage. So the budget is £4,000, which converts out to a little bit over $5,000. That's what we're looking to spend. Looking for something that is not a burden to own. So no project cars here. If you started off the podcast and you're still with us, no project cars. No more than 90,000 miles traveled. Been looking at 1.6-liter diesel Focuses, the Kia Soul, the Qashqai. The car tax in the UK is making ownership of certain cars a pretty big problem. I'm not certainly, I'm not really fully understanding of that, but I totally believe you. It's a complicated time to do, you know, basically anything. So yeah, would love to chat through this. Would love to have a few beers. Hey man, listen to the last, was it two shows ago where we talked about beers? I guess we'll leave it right there. But what do you guys think? Oh, and I don't know if I did this right off the top, but the writer is, I'm not sure if this is Ivor. Hope I get that right. But Ivor, but hey, thanks for writing. Love this email. This is so thorough. I love it when we get emails like this. And why don't we start off with you, John?
Okay. The Qashqai is good. That's solid. That's, you know, basically the Rogue Sport here, which I've driven. It's comfortable. It's, you know, there's really nothing bad to say about it, really. So that's a solid choice. I see a lot of them. I'm looking on Auto Trader. In the UK, I'm seeing a lot of them over there. I have seen a couple higher mileage, you know, like pushing more close to 100,000 BMW 1 Series, and that's
I like
where
that
I would.
Call. Yeah,
if you don't have to live with it for too long, and I don't know, you might get some electrical gremlins and other things going on, but it's such a cool car to be able to drive. So if you can stretch that mileage a little bit, I would look at that. There's also, you know, the Hyundai i30, seeing a lot of those, which is very, you know, the Elantra, which is a good car to drive. All around, comfortable, good amount of content. I would probably do that. I like the sort of more car-like driving than the Qashqai. But if you can hack it and you can find one that's not going to ruin your life, try and find a one series.
I love that idea. I'm going to steal that one right now and just jump in here and go with that. But I'm also, I would probably, before you said that, I was leaning more towards the Ford. I'm seeing a Focus with the 1.6 liter in it. It's actually an estate, which is kind of a cool look, aka a wagon. The one I'm finding on motors.co.uk has 37,000 miles, and it costs almost 7,000 pounds. So it's a little bit out of budget, but it's way lower miles. So, you know, that's a thing. I'm sure you can find one of these if Focuses are as ubiquitous in the UK as they are here. I'm sure you can just sort of subtract them or add the miles, subtract the money, and find one like that. I don't know if the estate body style is what you're looking for, but I think that's cool. And also, you know, John's answer is sterling as well. So let's kick it over to you, Joel. I'm going to let you go last because usually for Spend My Monies, you have like just some out of the box idea. There's no reason I go last other than I'm usually out of breath from reading the long letters. But Joel, the floor is yours. Take us home.
Yeah. Kind of wish that you didn't talk me up this time because this is a blind spot for me. The UK and European car market used cars is a lot different than in the States, because you guys get a lot more cars that we don't. And even the cars that you do get have a lot of engine and transmission options that we don't get here, especially diesels. Even from companies that, like, in the States, we don't associate as with ever having diesels, like Hondas and Toyotas with diesels. And I'm like,
yeah,
is it any good? I have no idea. Like, they don't exist here. They've never existed here. So this is kind of a blind spot for me. So I'm going to be, I think the cars that you're looking at, Qashqai, Focus, and Kia Soul, I don't think you can go wrong with any of those. I think those would be solid choices. And anytime that I have read like UK magazines or watched UK shows, I've never heard a bad thing about European Fords. So like if you were looking at a Focus or a Mondeo or going smaller with like a Fiesta, I think any of those would be good choices. I think I could probably recommend Honda Civics too. I think they're probably good no matter where you are in the world. I think something probably worth looking at, especially because you're looking at, I'm assuming you're probably considering a diesel because you're not wanting to spend a whole lot of money on this. Diesel's going to be cheaper than gas out there. And they're probably going to be cheaper up front anyway. So I think I would look around at Skodas because they're just Volkswagens, but cheaper. And like the last few years, I've never heard a bad thing about kind of recent Volkswagen Group Skodas, that they basically offer all of the niceties of a regular Volkswagen, sometimes more, but for a lot cheaper price. So I'd say like look for a Skoda version of like any kind of Volkswagen, like a Passat or a Golf, like look for the Skoda version of that. And I mean, yeah, look for something cheap and like pick up something fun later when you're kind of more settled down. Oh gosh, there was something on the tip of my tongue that I'm blanking on that I saw on AutoTrader that I was like, oh, hey, that's something that I kind of forgot about that would be kind of cool.
We can throw it in the comments if we don't get it.
Let me stall just a minute or two more. Yeah, and I mean, it looks like there are a lot of options in your price range and mileage requirements. So it shouldn't be too hard to figure to find something that you like. But yeah, I'm thinking like looking at Fords, looking at Skodas, maybe some VWs. I think those would be strong all around options.
Oh man, I'm looking at a Citroen C3 Picasso right now. That's pretty cool.
Oh, I know what I was going to suggest. Suzuki Swift. It's
a little bit.
Good one.
It's a little bit on the small side, considering what you're kind of looking at right now. But I've heard they're very fun to drive. You can get them with a diesel if you want. I'm not sure what the turbo, what the kind of higher power gas ones go for now. But I've that's a car that I personally have really wanted to drive. So Swift is something that maybe you should look at too. But Ford's VWs and maybe like Honda Civic, I'd say those are good. Those are ones to check out.
We will start off with project cars skewing towards American muscle, and we will end with the Suzuki Swift. Guys, this show has been a lot of fun, although I'll admit it's been anything but Swift. We are over an hour into it. Ivor, thank you for writing. This is a great spend my money. Have a Scapa special on me if you need to know that reference. Reach back to a couple shows ago when I compared it to the Land Rover Defender. Available in the UK, it was their original pale ale. I find them delicious, and they have a battleship on the label. Guys, thanks for joining this week. It's been a fun show. Be safe out there. We'll see you on the other side.